Thanks very much, Stephen, for that invitation, for that introduction, and for the invitation to come and speak tonight. This is the second time that I've had the privilege of participating in the ABE's annual forecasting conference, and it's a real pleasure for me to be back here amongst so many colleagues and friends. As Stephen said, the title for my remarks this evening is in the form of a question. And that question is, what is normal? Now, the Oxford Dictionary defines the word normal as conforming to a standard, usual, typical, or expected. So the question of what is normal seems an appropriate one for an annual forecasting conference. For many of us, our days are spent looking at economic and financial developments and asking whether they are usual, typical, or expected. And if we conclude they're not, then we ask ourselves, will things return to normal? And if so, when? Or has normal changed? Like many of you, I suspect, I often get asked if what we're seeing is normal, the new normal, perhaps the old normal, or is it just something plain different? Now, in many areas of life, our perceptions of what is normal are crucial to how we feel about what's going on around us. There are, for example, a range of human behaviours that were once considered normal, but would cause many of us considerable angst if we saw them today. So what's considered normal and entirely unremarkable in one context can be viewed very differently in another. Context and experience are important. So with that in mind, my remarks this evening are split into two parts. The first, I want to look back over Australia's recent economic performance and what it means for people's perceptions of what is normal. And then second, I'd like to talk about some issues related to monetary policy and what's considered normal there. So first, to Australia's recent economic performance. On a number of fronts, the past 20 years have been very good ones for the Australian economy. During the early part of that period, the economy was recovering from the sharp downturn of the early 90s recession. We then had the boom in housing prices and credit. That was followed by a sharp rise in the terms of trade, which was only temporarily interrupted by the financial crisis in the North Atlantic. And most recently, we've seen a boom in investment in the resources sector. Over these 20 years, we've experienced almost uninterrupted growth, a feat not matched by any other developed economy. The banking systems remain strong, the fiscal accounts have been kept in good order, and inflation has remained under control. It's fair to say that these outcomes are better than was widely expected 20 years ago. If we use our own history, or if we use overseas experience as a guide, these outcomes collectively could hardly be described as usual, typical, or expected. Indeed, they have been better than what might reasonably be considered normal. Importantly, this experience leaves our country with a very positive legacy. More of us have jobs than ever before. Our incomes are noticeably higher. We are wealthier. And our economy has moved up the global league tables. But this experience has also affected how many of us view our current economic situation. After such a good run, there is a sense of disappointment or dissatisfaction in parts of the community that we're not repeating all aspects of this earlier experience. 20 years of good economic performance and rising asset prices raised our expectations of what is normal, and many in the community are a little disappointed that these higher expectations are not being fully met. And I suspect this is one factor that helps explain why the public mood has been a bit flat over recent times, despite what many outside observers or outside the country viewing the Australian economy with some considerable envy. Now, this change in what's considered normal is adding to the adjustments that are going on in the economy. And to illustrate the change and the unusual nature of the events that preceded, I want to show you six graphs. The first one here is of growth in consumption per capita. If you smooth out the volatility in the data, you can see that the period from the mid-1990s to the mid-2000s was a quite unusual one. Consumption growth per person was consistently strong, was faster than over the preceding years and faster than over recent years. And this is true for both retail trade and consumption of services. The second graph is really a corollary of the first and is of the household saving rate. From the mid-1980s up until the mid-2000s, the saving rate was on a downward trend. Or put differently, growth in consumption was consistently faster than growth in our incomes. For part of this period, we spent every extra dollar we received in income and then a bit more. This could hardly be described as normal or sustainable. More recently, the saving rate's increased and it's back to the level where it was in the mid-1980s. The third graph is of the household debt and is of household debt and wealth relative to disposable income. And here the story is similar. From around the mid-1990s to the mid-2000s, the value of both our assets and the value of our liabilities rose much more quickly than our incomes. Because the value of our assets increased at a faster rate than the value of our liabilities, there was a large increase in measures of household net worth relative to our income, and you can see that in the top line of that graph. Again, such a large adjustment is unusual, and in recent times, the steady rise in these various ratios has stopped, and we're roughly back to where we were a decade ago. This fourth graph is of the share of the dwelling stock that's sold each year. During the latter part of the 1990s and the first part of the 2000s, turnover in the property market was unusually high. More than ever before, we moved homes or bought and traded second properties, either as an investment or as a holiday property. And the high rate of turnover boosted many parts of the economy, including the real estate sector and parts of the retail sector. It also boosted state government finances due to higher stamp duty revenue. But over the past few years, turnover has declined and is currently around half the rate that it was in the early 2000s. This fifth chart is of the share of the working age population that has a job. Again, over the period from the mid-1990s to the mid-2000s, employment consistently grew more quickly than the working age population. While this partly reflects a rise in labour force participation by females, this type of experience sustained over a long period is, again, unusual. And as in some of the other charts that I've showed you, we see a levelling out in the ratio over recent times. And finally, this sixth graph shows the increase in our living standards measured by the rise in real income per hour worked, together with the increase in average productivity. Something rather unusual has happened here too, although the timing's a little bit different from the previous five graphs. Over the past decade, there was a decoupling of the link between the rate of advance in our living standards and growth in productivity, with living standards increasing noticeably more quickly than growth in productivity. We found ourselves in this very favourable situation because of the very material rise in Australia's terms of trade that occurred over these years. Now, these developments in the six graphs have their roots in a number of influences. The first is financial liberalisation and the return to low interest rates in the 1990s after the high inflation of the 70s and the 80s. And the second is the large increase in Australia's terms of trade due to strong growth in Asia and China in particular. The strong productivity growth in the 1990s and the recovery from the early 1990s recession also played some role in these developments. Importantly, financial liberalisation and lower nominal interest rates gave households increased access to debt, and many households took advantage of this. This pushed up the price of housing, and some households used their increased equity to fund higher consumption. Financial liberalisation and rising house prices were also associated with the increased rate of turnover in the property market that I talked about. Financial institutions were amongst the many that benefited from this, with rapid balance sheet growth and unusually low levels of problem loans. Collectively, these developments also helped generate strong employment growth. This boosted fiscal revenues, as did the large increase in the terms of trade, and this boost of revenues made possible frequent cuts in personal income tax rates. Now, this process of adjustment to financial liberalisation and lower interest rates took a long time to play out, at least a decade and probably a bit longer than that. This long adjustment had made it more difficult to determine what was normal. If something happens year after year, there's a tendency to think it can happen continually, and some people start to make their plans accordingly. However, when the adjustment is finally complete, there can be a period of disappointment when the previous trends don't continue. And at least with hindsight, the response to financial liberalisation and lower interest rates looks to have run its course around the mid-2000s. At that time, we largely avoided a sense of disappointment because of the second influence that I talked about. That's the large run-up in the terms of trade that was starting in the mid-2000s. Now, one concrete example of how the past influences our interpretation of current developments is in the way people currently interpret the behaviour of consumers. In particular, it's been commonplace to talk about the cautious consumer, and I myself have done this frequently, including, I think, when I last spoke at this dinner. But increasingly, I wonder whether or not this is the best description. Certainly, using the earlier years as the benchmark, consumers do look to be cautious. Consumption growth is slower than it was, the saving rate's higher, and credit growth is lower. But are these earlier years the most suitable benchmark? And I suspect the answer is they're not. Over the past couple of years, consumption has been growing broadly in line with income. That does not look to be particularly cautious, although it is different. Growth in household borrowing has also been broadly in line with household income. Again, that doesn't look particularly cautious, but it is different. It may be more appropriate to describe this behaviour as prudent rather than cautious. Indeed, it might be described as normal. The general point I'm trying to make is that there's a recalibration going on regarding what is considered normal. Having consumption, credit, and asset prices grow broadly in line with incomes should probably be viewed as usual, typical, or expected. And so too should the rate of increase in our living standards being determined by productivity growth. I want to make it clear I'm not saying that we have to accept inferior economic outcomes from those that we've had on average over the past 20 years. Indeed, Australia remains very well placed to benefit from the growth of Asia, and we have many advantages, including our skilled workforce. But on the financial side, we are unlikely to repeat this previous experience, and nor should we aspire to. There was an adjustment to take place, and that adjustment has occurred. Whether we can take advantage of the opportunities that lie ahead and continue to enjoy the rate of increase in our living standards that we've become used to depends crucially on productivity growth. The contribution the Reserve Bank can make here is to maintain low and stable inflation to keep the economy on an even keel. Beyond that, it's in the hands of businesses, in the hands of workers, and in the hands of government to deliver the type of changes that will drive the next round of productivity improvements. As quite a few people have noted recently, this needs to be very high on our national agenda. I'd now like to change tack a bit and talk about the concept of normal as it applies to four issues related to monetary policy. And the first of these is inflation. The key point here is that low inflation has become normal in Australia. Most consumers and businesses now view it as usual, typical or expected, that inflation will average 2-point-something over time. Australians and those doing business here can make their investment and spending decisions without having to worry about the possibility of a rapid and unexpected increase in the general level of prices. That's quite different to the case in the 1970s and the 1980s. And it's perhaps the biggest benefit that we've obtained from the medium-term inflation target that we've had for the past two decades. The second issue is one where the news is not so good, particularly for many in this audience. The unfortunate reality is that in the area of forecasting, it is normal for forecasts of economic activity to be wide of the mark. This is evident in work recently undertaken by two of my colleagues at the bank who looked at the history of our own forecasts. They concluded that, and here I quote, the RBA forecasts explain very little of the variations in GDP growth, medium-term changes in unemployment, or the medium-term deviations of underlying inflation from the target. These conclusions are obviously challenging for those of us involved in the forecasting process. But the reason that I raise this issue is that we are, at the bank, very cognizant of the limits of forecasting and that it's normal for outcomes to vary materially from what we expected. This can occur because of changes in the global economy or because of structural changes that are going on in our own economy. And it means, as Glenn Stevens said in a speech to this audience just last year, that monetary policy decisions should not be rigidly or mechanically linked to the forecasts. Of course, this does not mean that the process of forecasting is unimportant. I know from my experience at the bank that this process forces questions to be asked and it forces issues to be analysed, and therefore it's a central part of good monetary policy. But because it is commonplace for there to be fairly high levels of uncertainty around point forecasts, there's an important role for the judgment of policymakers here as well. The third issue that I want to touch on is the normal level of interest rates. For much of the decade or so before the financial crisis, it was normal for headline mortgage rates to move in near lockstep with the cash rate. This has obviously changed over recent years as bank funding costs and hence mortgage rates have risen relative to the cash rate. As the bank has noted many times, the board has taken account of this in its monthly policy decisions. As a result, the cash rate today is around 1.5 percentage points lower than it otherwise would have been. And the fact that the bank has offset the effect of higher funding costs on lending rates means that the normal level of the cash rate is lower than it otherwise would have been. So a 3% cash rate today is not the same as a 3% cash rate in the past. The more difficult issue to assess is the normal level of lending rates as opposed to the normal level of the cash rate. It's difficult to be definitive here, but there are a couple of reasons why the normal level of lending rates may be lower, at least for a time, than was the case over the past two decades. Now, the first reason is the international environment. As I talked about in another speech recently, many of the countries that avoided the financial crisis are experiencing uncomfortably high exchange rates and low interest rates. Australia is clearly one of these. With the major economies of the world quite weak, most other countries would see them benefiting from a lower exchange rate to boost their exports. But of course, given the exchange rate is a relative price, not every country can simultaneously have a lower exchange rate. It shouldn't really come as a surprise that the countries that are in relatively good shape, like Australia, and that have not seen large-scale expansion in the central bank balance sheet, are experiencing stronger currencies than those that are in relatively poor shape. After all, this is one of the mechanisms through which weak conditions in most of the advanced economies are transmitted to the rest of the world. And in response to this, interest rates are lower than they otherwise would have been to offset some of the effects of the uncomfortably high exchange rate. The second factor that might have an influence on the normal level of lending rates is related to the issues that I spoke about at the beginning. For most of the past 20 years, we were benefiting from either the credit boom or the terms of trade boom. Under the influence of these two factors, one might have expected, all else constant, higher average lending rates than otherwise, as both factors boosted aggregate demand relative to supply, well, at least for a period. Another way of thinking about this is that in the earlier period, there was an increase in the rate of time discount and correspondingly an increase in the normal level of interest rates. Although the high terms of trade are still boosting aggregate demand, the aftermath of the credit boom and the gradual realisation that this experience is unlikely to be repeated, actually working in the other direction, and all else constant, this might be expected to lead to lower average lending rates than during this earlier period. Now, of course, all else is not constant, including the amount of spare capacity in the economy, the nature of the capital flows, and the rate of productivity growth. But it is possible that normal lending rates will be somewhat lower for a period due to a combination of these global factors and the legacy of the credit boom. Whether or not this actually turns out to be the case depends upon a whole range of factors, including how cost and price pressures in the economy evolve. This brings me to my fourth and final issue, and that is whether we are seeing a normal response of the economy to the reductions in interest rates that have occurred over the past year or so. Now, assessments in this area are notoriously difficult, not just because there is a very wide range of historical response, but also because of the challenge of determining what is the normal level of lending rates. However, the current response across a large number of indicators is falling within the range of outcomes that we've seen in the past. There do appear, though, to be some differences in the behaviour of households and of businesses. In particular, while a number of the household indicators have picked up a bit, business confidence and conditions have not. And this difference between the household sector and the business sector will obviously bear close watching over the period ahead. One other area where the response has been smaller than typical is the exchange rate, which has remained high. Perhaps the more important conclusion from this work, though, is that monetary policy still looks like it's working. There are lags, and different parts of the economy respond at different paces. But lower interest rates are still effective in providing a boost to the overall economy. So on that note, I'd like to conclude. I wish you all the best of luck in your journey of discovery of what is normal, of what's usual, typical, or expected. One difficulty that I suspect we all face is that when we think we've found the answer, it seems to change. So perhaps the one constant is that it's uncertainty that is normal. Thank you very much, and I'd be pleased to answer any questions. Thank you.
Matthew Johnson, UBS. I'd like to ask a question about graph number 6, which shows the divergence between real GDI and GDP per hour worked. We saw in today's national accounts a hint of the convergence of those two lines, with productivity increasing somewhat and real GDI falling a bit. I would like to hear your thoughts on what it will mean if those two series do indeed converge and we have a period where real GDI is flat or negative for a while, but real GDP looks okay. What do you think that'll mean for inflation and unemployment?
Yeah. Well, I think this is going to be a real challenge for us because we've had a decade where, as I said, our living standards increase more quickly than productivity growth. That's not going to happen, I predict, in the next decade. If the terms of trade come off a bit further, which I suspect they will, then growth in real income for a while will be slower than growth in productivity. And that's going to pose a challenge for the community if that turns out to be the case. This is why I think this focus on productivity is just so crucial. We've enjoyed 20 years of really remarkable increase in our living standards, and given the likely movements in the terms of trade, we need to lift productivity growth. And I'm tentatively optimistic here. And as you say, we see this in the national accounts today, that productivity growth has picked up. When we talk to businesses, they say the same thing, that they're now making changes that really many of them have delayed over time, and that the difficult conditions that many of them face are actually forcing them to finally confront business practices, in some cases to invest in new technology. It's really important that that continues. If it doesn't, then we'll have to get used to lower growth in our living standards, and that's going to be difficult for our society. But I'm cautiously optimistic that we're starting to see the changes that are necessary.
Warren Bird from Colonial for a little bit longer. Concept of normal and the concept of neutral, are they the same thing, or do you do you mean something different when you talk about normality?
I think I'm we're really talking
to interest rates and the
I think policy. I think we're really talking about the same thing, and that the sense is, well, the, at least the possibility is that the neutral level of interest rates is going to be lower for a period of time. It's clear that's the case on the cash rate because of the higher funding costs for financial institutions, and it may also be the case on lending rates for the factors that I talked about.
Deputy Governor, it's Sue Lannan from ABC News. Now, yesterday in the Reserve Bank statement, it said that capital markets were open and Australian banks were having no problems getting funding. So is it justified today that the big banks only cut their mortgage lending rates by 20 basis points?
Well, I'm not going to comment on their individual business decisions. I think there are two points that are worth making, though. One is that, as I said in my prepared remarks, that we take into account what they're doing, and so ultimately the Reserve Bank is offsetting the widening spread between the cash rate and the mortgage rate from the higher funding costs. So in the end, mortgage rates are where we think they broadly should be. I think the other point that I make is that we are seeing some lessening of the pressure on bank funding costs. The wholesale spreads that the banks are paying are coming down, and perhaps we're seeing some very early signs of the very intense competition in the deposit market easing off a fraction. I think it's a bit early to conclude that with confidence, but there are some signs that that's occurring. If both those trends were to continue, then you would expect to see first some stabilisation in the spread between the cash rate and the mortgage rate, and then hopefully some decline in that spread as well. But I don't think we're there yet, but we're getting closer to it than we have been.
And if I could just have a quick follow-up. You said that monetary policy is working, but is monetary policy being hampered by fiscal policy? We saw in the economic growth figures today that government spending was a drag on growth in the September quarter. Is the federal government's pledge to return the budget to surplus this financial year making your job harder?
No, not at all. I think monetary policy is working. One of the things it has to take into account is growth in aggregate demand, and the contraction in public demand, or the very weak growth in public demand, is clearly putting some constraint on overall demand growth in the economy. But we've known that for some time, and we've prepared our forecasts on the basis of that. So it's not hampering the effectiveness of monetary policy, but it is a factor that's affecting aggregate demand growth in the economy. That's clear, and we're responding to aggregate demand growth.
Joanna Heath from the Financial Review. I also have two questions, if I may. The first one is, if interest rates are lower than they otherwise would be due to the high exchange rate and also the retail banks not passing on cuts in full, is the RBA concerned at all that those lower rates might lead to distortions in the economy? And the second question is, if it's wrong to describe 3% as an emergency level, what might an emergency level actually look like?
Can I take the second question first? I think the word emergency became used a few years ago because the global economy was in an emergency. I mean, we had output in many of the advanced industrial economies falling by 4%, 5%, and 6%. Industrial production in many countries fell 20%. The volume of global trade fell 20%. Financial institutions around the world were on the brink. That was an emergency. And all arms of policy responded to that. Monetary policy, fiscal policy, we had a bigger depreciation of the exchange rate. So that was an emergency for the global economy. That's not the world we're in now. So I would not describe these as emergency settings of interest rates. We're not in an emergency. Partly we're accommodating this decline in the normal level of interest rates, and partly the outlook for growth is a bit softer than we'd expected. So that has led to lower interest rates than we had previously. So it's certainly not an emergency. Sorry, in answering that, I've forgotten your first question.
If interest rates are lower than they otherwise would be, is that a concern for the RBA in terms of potentially creating distortions in the economy?
Well, in principle, it could. And the typical concern that people would have worried about here is that the very low lending rates created an incentive for people to borrow to buy assets that pushed up asset prices and created financial instability problems later on. And you, if you look around the world at the moment, you see a number of central banks who are quite worried about this. In a few of them, they've recently imposed restrictions on loan-to-value ratios. I think in Israel, for example, there's a restriction now of 50% on the LVR on an investor loan because they're worried that the low interest rates will lead to upward pressure on asset prices. So in principle, that could become an issue here. At the moment, I see no signs of that. I don't see signs of reduction in lending standards. I don't see a return to a voracious appetite for borrowing. So I don't see any signs of that, but it could become an issue, and that would be something that we'd have to think about very carefully.
Might mix it up.
David Plank from Deutsche Bank. Dr. Lowe, actually related to the last answer that you gave, one question that came up during the conference was whether it was a necessary condition that rates had to go to zero before a central bank would consider QE. And I suppose here, thinking about the distortionary effects of rates going to zero, there might be a trade-off in terms of other policy measures before you got there. I just wondered what your thoughts might be on that question.
Yes, so we're talking hypothetically here.
Very hypothetical. That's understood here. Given that you've got 300 to go, yes.
I think, unfortunately, there's quite a lot of experience here, and the conclusion that I would have drawn from most of that experience is that once you get below some certain level of very low interest rates, that the incremental benefit from lowering them further is quite small. But that threshold level of very low interest rates is quite a long way below where we are now, somewhere around 1%. Plus or minus a bit. I think once you get there, other options of unconventional monetary policy become more viable. Until you get there, I don't really see a strong case for doing these other unconventional things.
Right, so next year maybe, but anyway, thanks.
Over there. Paul Bloxham, HSBC. I found your first six charts very interesting and thought the timing was rather interesting as well. The productivity growth slowdown that we've seen happen really started around about 2003, 2004 on those charts, around about the same time that the financial liberalisation process in terms of allowing people to take on more debt also ran to its end. So I wonder whether there's a link between those two things. You described the financial liberalisation story as a credit boom and a demand side story, but whether in fact that also has an impact on the supply side, whether we could expect that because financial liberalisation looks as though it's run its course, we might have to accept lower rates of growth in the economy and productivity growth simply because we're not continuing to liberalise the financial system. Or indeed, we may have liberalised it too much earlier and now there's some catch-up involved.
Yeah. Well, in my remarks, I focused very much on the demand side effect of the financial liberalisation and lower interest rates, because I think that did have a big impact on the financial side of the economy. But we've got to remember that through the 1990s, we also enjoyed quite strong productivity growth, and that was coming from the supply side, from the reforms that had taken place through the late 1980s and the early 1990s, and that was very important in driving both supply and demand so that the economy could grow strongly with low inflation.
I guess what I'm saying, sorry to follow up, is that part of the productivity slowdown may in fact be that the financial liberalisation process has slowed down and that boosted the supply side, not the demand side. But it's actually...
Now you may be right. I don't really see the financial liberalisation process as fundamental to the expansion of the supply side during that period. It may have had some effect. The main impact was allowing greater increase in a greater availability of credit and higher asset prices. I think the slowdown in productivity growth is... I mean, no one really knows the answers here, but there was accelerated policy change in the 1990s, and our society benefited a lot from that. The rate of change has probably slowed down a bit, and I suspect... Now, I know this is an individual, that when things are going quite well, you probably take your foot off the pedal a little bit. And I think probably collectively our society has done that. The business has probably done it. The workforce collectively has probably done it. And our government may well have done that as well. If that's the case, then I think what we're seeing now is actually the pressure come back to put our foot on the pedal a bit more. And as I am in response to the first question, I think we're starting to see that. That's why I'm kind of cautiously optimistic that, productivity growth is going to lift here, because the difficult conditions that many people face is making them confront decisions that they haven't faced confronted for quite a while.
Dr. Rory Robertson, Westpac Group Treasury. Thanks for a fascinating talk. You mentioned that the Reserve Bank has published a brutally honest assessment of its forecasting record over the past two decades. And I think there were two main findings. One was that the Reserve Bank's forecast record is hopeless. And the second finding was that the Reserve Bank's forecasting record was better than the average of business economists, many of us in this room. So I think the economists among us won't thank you for the Reserve Bank for publishing that. It's been economists' dirty little secret that our forecast record has been poor. At least we thought it was a dirty little secret, but in fact over those 20 years the customers figured out that the economists' forecast records were hopeless. How do we deal with that uncertainty? How should the central bank and investors deal with the fact that the future is unknowable? as head of the Reserve Bank's risk management area.
Well, that's a very open question. I think the best I can do is to make some comments on how that influences our decision-making processes and how we use the forecasts internally. So a set of numbers are prepared, but we really use those numbers to have internal discussions of the forces that are shaping the economy. So it's not really the numbers per se that our discussions are focused on, but what is actually driving those numbers. And I think that I personally find that process incredibly valuable, because it makes you think about issues, it makes you discuss the forces that are driving the economy, and as a public official or as an investor, I think that must be the fundamental starting point for making good decisions. We'll never get all the answers right, but you could expect the central bank to have very detailed discussions of the forces driving the economy, try and articulate them publicly like we do frequently. And I would expect private investors to be doing the same thing, focusing on the forces that are driving the economy. And ultimately, hopefully, that leads to better decision-making in this uncertain world we live. I don't think I can give a better answer than that, really.
Over to David.
Dave Bassanese from the Financial Review. Just take you back to the statement that was put out earlier this week, and you mentioned the mining investment boom cycle, I guess, was approaching. And the earlier talk from the Reserve Bank had been about a peak in mining investment sometime later next year. I guess your reaction to the CapEx survey, which in an article last week I described as devastating, had quite a major downgrade to investment expectations, both mining and the non-mining sector. Does that lead you to think that the peak in mining investment is now earlier than you previously thought? And is it conceivable that mining investment has already peaked now?
Yeah, well, a good set of questions. That latest CapEx data had stronger growth in the September quarter, but the outlook was downgraded, as you know. We had already factored a fair amount of that into our forecast, because we have this extensive liaison program where we talk to people in the industry, and they're typically quite frank with us. So we had a strong sense that something like this downgrade would occur. I think it does mean that the peak in mining investment's earlier than we would have thought at the beginning of this year. Earlier on, we thought, well, that peak could be in late 2013. It now looks earlier than that. I'd probably describe it really as a plateau rather than a peak. If you look at the investment numbers by quarter, they're very jumpy. So it's hard to know which quarter is actually going to be the peak. So I prefer to think of this as kind of as a plateau that we're going to see in the first half of next year. But that is a bit weaker than we'd previously thought.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. Dr. Lowe, a lot of questions on Australia. So can I ask your opinion on the United States? The US economy, in my opinion, seems to be building some solid fundamentals. They've made a lot of adjustments. And the markets right now are highly focused on this fiscal cliff, which is obviously a highly political issue. Can you give us some of your thoughts on where to for the US economy over the next year or so? And putting the political stuff aside, you know, do you see the prospects of the US economy bouncing back as being likely?
Yeah. Well, putting the political stuff aside is a big thing to do. But I'm prepared to do that. I think if they can work through that in a reasonable way, the prospects for the US economy now look more evenly balanced the risks look more evenly balanced than they have to me for quite some time. And perhaps even things are moving slightly to the upside. The housing market seems to have turned. Corporate balance sheets are in very good shape. Consumer confidence is still depressed, but it has picked up. Corporates have not done that much investment over recent years, so there's a need to replace some of the capital stock. The population in the US is still growing. So they're all things that would give you a reason to be optimistic if you're so inclined. And there's still big issues for them to deal with, but you can now write down a list of issues that give you cause for optimism, whereas up until very recently, it's been hard to do that. Of course, all that could be derailed by a bad outcome on the fiscal thing, and who knows how that's going to turn out, and I think that's why people are so nervous at the moment. But if we can get through that, then I think that the risks are moving slightly to the upside in the US. Good place to be after the last 6 years.
Ivan Cahoon from ANZ. I was just wondering if you could share some thoughts about what discussions you might be having about what the bank could do about the currency if, for example, nothing changed, we were in this unusual world and the currency kept going up. Beyond simply cutting interest rates, have you been thinking through that scenario and what can you share with us?
Well, as I said in my remarks, the exchange rate is uncomfortably high. But broadly, we can understand why it is like that. After all, the terms of trade are still at quite high levels historically, and many countries, the bank in the UK, the US, Japan, the euro area, are engaging in very large expansion of their central bank balance sheets, which will tend to put downward pressure on their currencies. So I can understand why the Australian dollar's high, but it is uncomfortable. The main policy option that any central bank has in this circumstance is to intervene. As I've said on a number of occasions, we would not rule that out, but it would be a very big step to take. The floating exchange rate regime has served us very well. I remember multiple occasions in the last 10 or 15 years when the exchange rates moved and people have felt very uncomfortable about it, but when you look back over time, it's been the single most stabilising influence on the Australian economy, and I would include the current last few years in that as well. So we wouldn't rule out intervention, but it would be a very significant step to take and quite a departure from the set of arrangements that have served us so well for so long now.
Bill Evans from Westpac. Dr. Lowe, I'm interested in the dynamics of your growth forecasts. You're expecting growth at 3% in 2014, which is only a little less than we're likely to get this year. But if we look at the contribution of mining and the swing factor there, that could be as much as 3 percentage points between 12 and 14. You've also observed that the household sector appears to be committed to maintaining its savings rate, so growth in the household sector will be limited to the pace of income growth, and you've pointed out that employment growth looks to be soft and wages growth appears to be contained. Does that mean that the achievement of this 3% growth in 14 will require quite a substantial response in non-mining business investment? And are you therefore somewhat disturbed that, as you pointed out, that non-mining business investment is just not responding? And next year we're going into an election year where political uncertainty might be an additional unwelcome factor on non-mining business investment, and you may well indeed have to lower that growth forecast if you don't see any response. And indeed then could the 3% in fact be 2%, which would be the new normal? Be quite acceptable.
Well, there are a lot of issues there. But I think you've really focused on the main issue, though, for the kind of the growth outlook. As mining investment as a share of GDP peaks and then kind of plateaus and then gradually drifts down a bit, other forms of spending will need to pick up. And the two obvious candidates there are residential investment and non-mining business investment. On the residential side, I think we can start to see the signs of a gradual pickup there. The building approvals have picked up a bit. We saw in the national accounts today a small rise in residential construction investment. I think the country needs that, and I think we're starting to gradually see that. The housing market indicators, a number of them have turned more positive. What we haven't seen yet is a pickup in investment in the non-mining sector in plant and equipment, or really in buildings. A pickup in that type of investment is generally quite slow to occur in an interest rate easing cycle. And I remember on other cases where people say, where's the investment going to come from, and agonising over that, but eventually it does come. Kind of the lower interest rates, a pickup in housing, moderate growth in consumption, and less capacity pressures coming from the mining sector in time should deliver a pickup in this type of investment. That's the central story of our forecast. Of course, if that doesn't happen, then some other form of spending would need to pick up. And if it didn't, then obviously that would have implications for macro policy. But at the moment, I think it's a plausible position to maintain that this, as it has in the past, that business investment and residential investment ultimately respond to lower interest rates.
Dr. Lowe, Elise Morgan from the ABC. If the reality of what happens next year and the year after comes in below forecasts, which, as you've said tonight, is a possibility, could you foresee that the RBA could run out of so-called ammunition? And if so, what happens?
Well, we're in the world of hypothetical scenarios again. I think it's quite unlikely that we reach that point. I mean, we shouldn't forget we have tremendous opportunities in this country and tremendous assets. To expect that we get down to 0 or 1% interest rates and run out of ammunition when we have those tremendous natural resource base and the tremendous skills, I think it's quite unlikely. Of course, it can't be ruled out, and so, like others, we have thought about that, but I think it's just quite unlikely we get there. And we've still got quite a lot of space before that occurs. If the US economy picks up a bit of strength and China continues to growth looks there like it's stabilised and could actually pick up a bit, that's not an environment where you would expect to see us run into the zero lower bound.